This is Sophie Wilson, and you are listening to the Slow Boat Sailing Podcast.
You can support the Slow Boat Sailing Podcast on patreon.com/slowboatsailing. In this episode of the Slow Boat Sailing Podcast, you will hear the first three chapters of Around the World Single-Handed, The Cruise of the Islander by Captain Harry Pigeon, about his 1921 to 1924 round the world trip. Slow Boat Sailing and Ox River Publishing are pleased to produce the first ebook and audiobook versions of this sailing classic. First, let's hear a word from our sponsor, Mantis Anchors. Why don't you tell me about how you came up with the swivel?
So people, they like to use them. And we would notice and explain to them a lot of the weaknesses that exist, that, you know, with the swivels that were on the market, and kind of make sure that they understood those cautions and saying, yeah, swivels have a function, but you're weighing that, you know, what you're gaining versus the risks that you're taking on the other hand. So you have to consider every situation on whether you really want to be utilizing the swivel or not. And I think that we just saw kind of like there's a need in the marketplace for something that was a better design and something more reliable.
We use the innovative heavy-duty Mantis swivel on our boat. So Around the World Single-Handed, The Cruise of the Islander by Harry Pigeon will be available on Amazon for 99 cents starting on Tuesday, April 24th, 2018 and going on Wednesday, April 25th, 2018 and Thursday, April 26th, 2018. Then the price is going to go up to its regular price of $8.99 on Amazon worldwide. Get it while it's 99 cents. And we appreciate it if you can write a rating or review for Harry Pigeon's classic. And that's for the ebook version of Harry Pigeon's classic, Around the World Single-Handed, The Cruise of the Islander, which I'm going to read the first three chapters here in just a minute. So the ebook for Kindle is exclusively available on Amazon. But if you would like to hear the audiobook version, at the moment it's exclusively available at patreon.com/slowboatsailing for people who pledge at least $5. So if you would like to get the full audiobook version, you could pledge $5 at patreon.com/slowboatsailing, and you will get two other audiobooks and all the bonus episodes going back to episode 10. So you get the audiobooks of my book, How to Sail Around the World Part-Time and Slow Boat to Cuba, all for that $5 pledge. I want to briefly, before we dive into the audiobook, say what an important sailor Harry Pigeon was. That he was the first man to sail in a small yacht around the world by the Panama Canal. And the route that he took, the Tradewind circumnavigation route, is really the route that the World Ark uses and most round-the-world circumnavigators use today. So if you're not in a sailing race, you're probably going to sail the trade winds, mostly in the southern hemisphere, underneath the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa, and through the Panama Canal. And that was just what Harry Pigeon did with his home-built wooden boat that he built on a beach for $1,000. It's an amazing story, and I'm so happy to bring it to you. Here it is. Around the World Single-Handed, The Cruise of the Islander by Harry Pigeon. Read by Linus Wilson. Production copyright, Ox River Publishing, Vermilion Advisory Services, 2018. This book was originally published by D. Appleton and Company, New York and London, in 1932. This audio recording may not be reproduced without the express written permission of Linus Wilson, Ox River Publishing, and Vermilion Advisory Services. Chapter 1. The Islander. The Islander was my first attempt at building a sailboat, but I don't suppose there ever was an amateur-built craft that so nearly fulfilled the dream of her owner, or that a landman ever came so near to weaving a magic carpet of the sea. As a youth, I was not favorably situated for taking up a seafaring career, but I had many qualifications for the job. My love of the sea did not come from early association, for I was born on a farm in Iowa and did not see salt water until I went to California when I was 18 years of age. So far as I know, none of my ancestors ever followed the sea. After some years spent on a ranch in California, I went to Alaska, where I acquired firsthand knowledge of boats. I had built a canvas canoe in California, but as I lived 30 miles from navigable water, I had not learned much about the use of it until I read Lieutenant Schwatka's Along the Great River of Alaska and decided to see that mighty stream. Another young farmer, Dan Williamson, joined me in the adventure. Following the trail of a party of prospectors and smugglers who had gone on before, we climbed the snowy Chilkoot Pass and built a boat on the shore of Marsh Lake, one of the sources of the Yukon River. It was a real boat made out of boards that we whipsawed from a spruce tree growing at hand. To propel our new craft, we had a pair of oars and a paddle. We launched our boat off the ice into a bit of open water at the foot of the lake. I had never had a pair of oars in my hands before, but I manned them now, and Dan took up the paddle. Our object was to get out of the lake and into the river that was flowing out of it. But Dan was not able to point the boat in that direction, and we only went round and round. I remembered that I had once paddled a canoe all of a half a mile, so we changed about. It seems that I had the knack, and Dan was strong on the oars. We left Marsh Lake early in the morning and reached Miles Canyon the same day after an exciting run on the swift stream where many lives were lost during the Klondike Gold Rush a few years later. At Miles Canyon, we found a party of four men who were portaging their outfits and two boats around the canyon. They volunteered to help us carry our boat over the portage. However, after taking a look at the place, I decided that we would run through, which we did the next morning. One of the party, Peter Lorentzen, stationed himself at the lower end of the canyon to see what would happen. When we came shooting out the gorge and rounded up the bank where Peter was standing, he said, "Well, you boys are sailors." My reply is, "If you'd seen us yesterday morning, you would not have said we were sailors." He still insisted, "I'm an old sailor, and I know that you boys are sailors." Peter lost his life when his boat swamped as he was following close after us through the Five Finger Rapids, but we were able to save his partner Henry and brought him to his destination at Circle, a new mining town on the Yukon. Beyond Five Finger Rapids in the Yukon was plain sailing for two farmers who had become sailors in a day. Late that fall, from St. Michael's Island at the mouth of the river, we took passage on the little freight steamer Bertha for California. I did not find it easy to settle down again after that wonderful summer on the Yukon, and I returned to Alaska, where I had many thrilling adventures on the rivers and lakes of the north. At one time, I owned a small vessel and sailed it among the islands of southwestern Alaska, but I never went out upon blue water, and most of my time was spent hunting and making photographs along the rivers and in the mountains of that great land. The experience that I gained while building small river boats from materials growing in the woods served me well when I came to build a seagoing vessel that carried me around the world, and life in the woods was a good school for developing resourcefulness. While on visit to my old home in Iowa, I remember that I had been one for my boyhood ambitions to float down the Mississippi River to the sea. After reading an account of a houseboat journey on the river, I concluded that such a cruise might be interesting. With this idea in mind, I went to Minneapolis, and there, just below the Falls of St. Anthony, built a small flatboat. I had many friends and relatives living along the river to cheer me on the way to the sea, to account so as to leave a dividend at the end. For more than a year, I was afloat on the river, and when I quit the little flatboat at Port Eads, I had resolved to see more distant lands in a vessel of my own. From that time, I began to take interest in sailing craft and to contemplate voyages. But it takes more than wishes to acquire a suitable craft and go on long voyages. So eventually I returned to California and became a photographer among the great trees of the Sierras. After a few years of this work, pleasant though it was, I longed for new scenes. About this time I came across the plan of a boat that seemed to be very seaworthy and, in addition, was not too large for one man to handle. Moreover, the construction of it did not seem too difficult for my limited knowledge of shipbuilding. Business with lumbermen and tourists in the big woods and the proceeds of the sale of a small farm put me in the possession of the necessary funds, so I decided to build my long-dreamed-of ship and go on a voyage to the Isles of the Sea. From the mountains, I went down to the shore of Los Angeles Harbor, located on a vacant lot, and began actual work of construction. The plan from which I was to model my ship was that had been drawn for Captain Thomas Fleming Day, who had wide experience in sailing small boats, and it was Captain Day's idea of what a small seagoing craft should be. It was V-bottomed, or seabird boat, a type developed by Captain Day and yacht designers on the staff of Rudder magazine. The reason for using the V-bottom type was that it was easier for the amateur builder to lay down and construct. Three safe and handy cruising boats were brought out of the plans published in Rudder. They were Seabird, Naiad, and Seagoer. The Islander was built after the lines of Seagoer, and the general construction plan is the same, but I used ideas from each of these boats and added some ideas of my own, as suggested by the material at hand and my limited resources. All the information I had when building the Islander is contained in a booklet published by Rudder Publishing Company of New York, How to Build a Cruising Yawl, containing instructions for building Seabird, Naiad, and Seagoer. With the coming in of the year 1917, the actual work of construction was commenced with the laying down of the keel. The timbers for the keel were 8 by 12 inches of thickness, and the largest piece 28 feet long. When I hear anyone talking about my frail craft, I always think of those keel timbers. They were cut to shape and saw in adz, and a piece of iron weighing 1,250 pounds was cast in the nearby foundry for the bottom piece of the keel, and to act as ballast when the timbers and iron ballast piece were bolted together with large iron bolts. They formed an exceedingly strong backbone for the frame of the vessel. Except for the stem and a few pieces of the cabin, which were oak, the wood used in the construction was of Douglas fir or Oregon pine. The timbers for the frame were all very heavy and reinforced at the bilge with steel plates that I cut from tank plate. After the frame was bolted together as strongly as possible, the planks were put in. The bilge strake and all above were full length in one piece. Working alone as I did, the planking was a long, hard job, and the thick, heavy boards were bent into place without the aid of a steam box. The bilge strakes were 2.5 inches thick and 7.5 inches amidships, tapering to 6 inches at the ends. These pieces were bent over 20 inches edgewise, as well as being brought round the curve of the sides. As they were in place, a carpenter from a boatworks looked at them and said, "I know how we would put those planks on at the shop, where we have a steam box and plenty of help, but how you got them on, I can't see." It was the most difficult piece of work about the construction, but when it comes to blocking up and driving wedges, they could not have beaten me in the boat shop. Those planks had come to place or break. That they would break was what I feared, but they did not break. Gradually, something like a boat began to appear, and spectators began to arrive, ask questions, and give advice. There was a beachcomber living in a shack nearby, who used to come and tell me that the keel of my boat was cut away too much forward. "She won't come up in the wind. She'll fall away to leeward." He informed me he was going to build a boat 50 feet long and 10 feet beam, in which he was going to Africa to hunt lions. He invented a reefing gear with which he could reef sails without leaving the wheel, was going to have an electric motor for an auxiliary and generate electricity with a windmill on deck. Nor was I the only boat builder on the shore. In sight of my works, but across the channel on the terminal side, a colored Moses was erecting an ark with which to transport a colony of his followers to Liberia. As he was laying down the keel, a question in regard to the size of his projected ship brought the answer that all depended on the donations he got. The donations seemed to keep coming in, for as my boat took shape, his grew into a structure 2 stories high with windows alow and aloft, and a stovepipe appeared through the broken pane. No doubt, as my boat was rising from the heap of timbers on the sand, it was often taken for another one of those freaks. But a yacht builder who became interested in what I was doing told a friend of mine that he could not do the work better himself. When the planking was on, the deck was laid and covered with canvas, and then the house was added. The sides of the house were one solid piece, each and carried aft to form the cockpit combings. The cabin was 12 feet long, arranged with a berth on either side, and spaces for drawers and wood-burning stove. Under the deck, between the house and the cockpit, was a good space where supplies for a long voyage could be stored. The cockpit was built watertight and self-bailing through lead scuppers carried straight down through the hull. When it came to caulking, I was advised to get a professional to do it. However, remembering the success I had in making small boats watertight, I approached this job with more confidence than almost any other in my new vessel, and few boats are so dry as mine. The masts were made and fitted, and the name Islander, which I had given the new ship, I painted on the stern board. I dug the ground away underneath and laid ways on which the vessel might slide into the water. Some friends who were intending to be at the launching thought that they would have time to see a ship launch from a nearby yard and then see the Islander go in, but my boat went in first. From the laying down of the keel to the launching, the Islander came near to being entirely the work of my own hands. The Islander was rigged as a yawl and was 34 feet long overall, 10 feet 9 inches beam, and drew 5 feet of water with no loading. She carried about 630 square feet of sail in her three sails. She was adapted to use auxiliary power, but for many reasons, mostly financial, I did not install a motor. However, the real sport is to make the elements take one where he wants to go. And then a motor never functions properly when left alone with me. For a tender I built for a little skiff 9 feet long, and when at sea, this was hauled on board, turned over against the house, and lashed fast, in the position it was carried wherever I sailed. The Islander cost me about $1,000 for material and a year and a half of hard work. When the sails were bent, yachting friends, who knew more about the rules of the road than I did, joined me, and we tried the new ship on a cruise to Catalina Island. She proved to sail well, and all remarked on the ease with which she handled. Many pleasant days were spent sailing along the nearby islands, sometimes with my friends, but more often alone, and in one of the many sunny coves in the lee of Catalina Island with my little ship might be found at all seasons. In the meantime, I procured books and instruments, and amid pleasant surroundings, I began to learn something of navigation. My method of navigation was simple, and it consisted of determining the latitude and longitude by observation of the sun, two simple problems that require no special ability to master. For the purposes of navigation, the earth is laid out in imaginary lines called meridians of longitude and parallels of latitude, which may be likened to the streets and avenues of a city. The position of the ship at sea and out of sight of land on these meridians and parallels can be solved only by astronomical observation. When one can solve these problems, he can find his way about as readily as he finds the numbers along the avenues and streets of a well-laid-out city. Dead reckoning I kept only mentally, and that merely to keep track of my positions between observations of the sun. The textbook on navigation that I used was Navigation by Harold Jacobi, but there are any number of excellent works on the subject. One must also have the Nautical Almanac. For navigating instruments, I had two compasses, sextant, protractor, parallel ruler, dividers, and a taffrail log. For keeping the time, I had two watches, one for the Greenwich Mean Time and one for local time. Of course, one should have charts and sailing directions for the places where one intends to call. At times, I found myself without either, which was rather inconvenient. To determine the latitude, one has only to get the declination of the sun out of the Nautical Almanac, and then ascertain the altitude of the sun at noon with the sextant. When the sun is between the observer and the equator, latitude equals 90 plus the declination, and minus the altitude. With the observer between the sun and equator, latitude equals the declination plus the altitude minus 90. If the observer and the sun are on opposite sides of the equator, latitude equals 90 minus the altitude minus the declination. The principle on which longitude is determined is simple. Calculations based on the latitude of the observer, the declination of the sun, and the altitude of the sun make known the local time at the moment of observation. At the same moment, the chronometer tells the Greenwich time. The difference between the two times then gives us the longitude. For the amateur navigator, I recommend Martelli's tables when working up a time sight. With these tables, the time sight is about as simple as the latitude sight, and it takes only half as long to solve the problem as it does with the sine and cosine method given in the standard works on navigation. These problems may be solved by observation of such stars as have their position given in the nautical almanac. But in actual practice on the deck of a small vessel pitching in a seaway, I find the sun is none too large. Also, under certain conditions of weather, the horizon is hard to define in broad daylight. While the theory of navigation is simple and easy to learn, seamanship, the ability to care for and handle a vessel under all conditions and stresses of weather, is acquired only by experience and long practice. When I felt myself competent, I set about preparations for an overseas voyage. Why did you do it is the question that I am most often asked in regard to my sailing alone. One of the best reasons I had was the lack of means with which to buy a larger vessel and hire crew to sail it for me. There is also great satisfaction in accomplishing something by one's own effort. Men have often said to me, "That is what I have always dreamed of doing, but you have done it." During my long voyage, I met several parties that were seeing the world from the decks of beautiful yachts, surrounded by friends and the luxury that wealth will buy, but none of them seemed to be getting the thrill of joy out of it that I was in my little yawl. When I was preparing to set alone across the ocean for the first time, I had something of a fellow feeling for those ancient mariners who believed that there was an abyss into which all ships would sail if they ventured into the unknown beyond the horizon. Then a little incident occurred that removed all doubt in my mind as to the question of sailing alone. My friend W., who had a yacht somewhat larger than mine, decided to break the monotony of the racing game with a cruise to the Hawaiian Islands. After enlisting two landsmen in the venture, it occurred to him that I would be a desirable addition to the expedition. With a view to getting valuable sea experience before going it alone, I gave the islander in charge of a friend and took my kit aboard the outbound yacht. We sailed into the gray of the morning, as befitted a crew of sea rovers. Among other stores in the galley was a box of plums that one of our shipmates had brought from his fruit ranch up country. Inspection showed the plums to be in an advanced stage of ripeness, so it was decided to eat them all at once. When clear of land, we ran into a brave southwest wind blowing about 35 miles an hour and kicking up a nasty sea. The yawl plowed through the billows nobly, tossing up clouds of foam and spray that drenched everything above board and ran into a stream through the skylight into the cabin. The hastily eaten plums soon found their way in the scuppers, but all day long the yawl did her 9 knots an hour on the course. As evening came on, I clung to the tiller wet and shivering, resigned to the prospect of standing an all-night watch. The skipper was below consulting with our disabled seamen who had taken to their berths. In the gathering gloom of dusk, he came up and abandoned. "This is going to be a wet, nasty trip, and I'm going back." I started to remonstrate, but it was no use. The morale of the crew was low, he said. He had enough of the deep sea stuff and did not think it would be wise to go on. Perhaps he was right. We sailed out all day and then sailed back all night. I returned to the Islander with the feeling that the problems of a single-handed sailor were comparatively simple. Chapter 2. A Voyage to Hawaii. My first ocean voyage in the Islander was to Hawaii. It was the greatest adventure of my life when I sailed alone with my new ship into what was to me an unknown region, and for the first time to put practical use the theories of navigation that I had lately acquired. The day could not have been fairer. Boats large and small were hurrying in and out on errands of business or pleasure, and among them the Islander glided on her way, stood out to sea. Out of the calm under the lee of San Clemente Island, she ran into the old familiar southwest wind that had so disheartened my companions on an earlier attempt at deep sea voyage. When discussing the question of single-handed sailing, I am continually being asked, "What do you do at night?" That was what I now began to learn for myself, and I lost a lot of sleep while doing it. Off the California coast, the southwest wind was ahead of the beam, and the Islander held the course well. But I did not feel like sleeping and spent most of the first night at sea crouched in the cockpit, sheltering myself the best I could from wind and spray. The wind abated somewhat, and on the second night, my little yawl, under shortened sail, sailed serenely on while I slept. On the evening of the fifth day out, the wind came round to the north and blew hard with a rough sea. I tied the third reef in the mainsail and stowed the mizzen, and all night long I sat at the tiller, keeping off when a white roller came up abeam. My eyes were tired with watching the compass, but when I dozed off for a moment, I would be roused up by a sea breaking over and drenching me with cold water. But the night wore away and the gale went down. With the rising sun, the dark storm clouds of the night broke into fleecy masses that drifted on and on until they passed beyond the horizon. When the sunlight broke through and fell on the sea, water was bluer than any I had ever seen, and the blue haze seemed to float over the surface. I had picked up the northeast trade winds. Once in the trades, I was running almost before the wind, and it required close attention to keep the little yawl on the course with all sails set. Finding that I was wearing myself out, I began to take things easier, and when the weather was boisterous, I stowed the main and mizzen sails at night and let the Islander run under the jib. Even then, the shivering of the jib at the leech was enough to keep me awake. In the end, I learned to shorten sail and get it balanced so that the Islander would sail on almost any course while I slept. If she did run off the course a bit, what of it? One night during a squall, the jib halyard parted and let the jib come down. When the weather moderated the next day, I rigged up the boatswain's chair on the peak halyard with which to go up and reeve in a new one. The motion of the masthead was so violent that it required all my strength to keep from being shaken off. After great exertion, I managed to get the job done and was glad to get down on deck with nothing worse than a few bruises. Ever afterwards, when I have been getting ready to go to sea, I have seen to it that the halyards and all aloft were in good order.
The method that I used in finding my way about on the sea was the simplest imaginable. When I was taking my departure from San Clemente Island, I put out a new log, but it soon ceased to register, and I never did get the thing to work. This little incident eliminated any work that I might have been attached to keeping track of my position by dead reckoning. The motion of my small vessel in a seaway is quick, if not actually violent, while the motion of the Islander did not interfere with my working ship or standing watch at the tiller. It was very different when I was below and attempted to solve the problem in mathematics. This very first time that I opened the tables and started to work a time sight, something began to gyrate in my head, and I realized that I was not immune to seasickness. I closed the old tome and did not work a time sight problem on the run. My method was to estimate the time as near as possible when taking the noon sight for latitude, and from this time get the approximate longitude. As I was intended to make landfall on the latitude, this seemed sufficiently accurate. I like company as well as anyone, but in my wanderings I have learned to go at it alone, so I was not fretting about the loneliness of the voyage. My chief worry was carrying sail at night and getting enough sleep at the same time. As I was passing into a new clime, there was usually something of interest to attract my attention during the daylight hours. At noon on the 13th day, when I threw up my sextant for a sight, I found I had passed under the sun, and for the first time I was south of it. On the same day, a beautiful white tropic bird, the first I had ever seen, paid the Islander a visit, and I began to realize I was in the tropics at last. One squally evening, I stowed the mainsail and left the Islander to find her way through the night. After I had eaten my evening meal and before I lay down, I went up to take a look around. I was not looking for land, and according to my reckoning, it was a long way off, but I was not sure about my navigation. A peculiar dark cloud loomed up ahead, and fragments of white clouds went driving over it, giving the appearance of a mountain. As I sat watching, a light twinkled, and it all appeared so real that I sprang to loose the mainsail with which to stand off a lee shore.
When I went into action, the light disappeared and the cloud began to break up. For a time, I stared in the darkness, and then turned into my berth to finish my dream. The only vessel sighted on the passage was a large four-masted schooner, her deck piled high with timber. She was in sight all day and slowly forged ahead of my little ship until she made a grand picture outlined against the golden glow of the sunset. I made no doubt that her destination was the Hawaiian Islands, and was more confident of my own navigation. The next day I saw great numbers of birds and began to watch for the appearance of land. On the 25th day out, I calculated my position to be north of the island of Hawaii, but heavy clouds obscured the horizon. Late in the afternoon, I sighted a dark object high among the clouds. It remained stationary and was in sight for about an hour before the clouds closed over it once more. It was land, and probably the summit of Haleakala on Maui Island. During the night, the islander drifted on under the jib, and with the coming of the daylight, I saw land on the port beam, where, below the low-lying clouds, the deeply furrowed side of the island sloped down to the sea. But there was not enough visible for me to recognize it. In the evening, I came up to Oahu, but mistook it for Molokai until I saw the flash of light on Makupu Head. I came up of Honolulu Harbor at midnight and lay off and on till morning, watching the twinkling lights of the city. I was tired and sleepy, and during my 26 days alone on the sea, I had lost much of my enthusiasm for single-handed sailing. With the coming daylight, I took a good look at the place, for the long beat back to California against the trade wind did not seem alluring, and I thought this was going to be my home for a long time. There was a fragrance in the breeze that came drifting out from the land. I was sea-weary, and so soon as the channel through the reef could be made out, I sailed in. But I did not go to shore that day. First, I had a discussion with the grizzled health officer, who seemed to think that I should have stayed outside until he had given me permission to come in. As soon as the anchor was down, visitors began to arrive. At the first opportunity, I lay down for a few minutes' rest. It was 9 o'clock that night before I awoke, and it was near 2 weeks before I had caught up on my sleep. It was the first visit to a tropical isle, and it seemed all the more wonderful to me coming, as I did, from my first long, lonesome voyage at sea. I found friends on the island, and the time passed pleasantly, whether it was spent hiking on the mountains or sitting on the shade along the shore. These splendid islands attract many notable visitors. While the islander was resting in Honolulu Harbor, the British cruiser Renown came up with the Prince of Wales on board, so they had the two of us there at the same time. My memory seems to retain pleasant impressions better than it does unpleasant ones. When recounting my voyage after coming on shore, it appears that I had not such a disagreeable time after all, and when a few of my new acquaintances had extended their compliments, I was in a frame of mind to try it again. Of the scenic places on the island, there was one that attracted me more than any other. It was Pali, against which the trade winds banked and surged. At one time, while I was at this romantic spot, a rainstorm swept up over the heights and from the gulch in the nearby cliff. A good-sized stream poured forth. The wind swept up the perpendicular rock wall, caught the stream as it left the gulch, and carried it up until it was blown to the mist. And one behold a waterfall going up instead of coming down. It was this wind that I had run before on my way to Hawaii, and against it I would have to contend on my way back to California. Among new acquaintances in Honolulu was a young man from California, Earl Brooks, who often accompanied me on sightseeing tours about the island. When I was making preparations for a return voyage, he proposed going with me. As his nautical experience had been limited to washing dishes on the Matsonia while on board bound for California, there seemed to be no danger of his wanting to take charge of the ship, so I took him on as mate. During the time the Islander lay in Honolulu Harbor, a coral crust had grown on her bottom. A day was spent scraping it off. We rowed in new running rigging, and as there was a possibility of running into rough weather, I made a sea anchor out of some boards. We put on ample supplies of food and water for many days, and Mr. Brooks bought a new guitar. When he came on board with his new acquisition, I asked him what he was going to do with it, and he said he was going to while away the time learning to play on it. Thinking of the thousands of miles of headwinds we were going to contend with, I concluded that he did not know what he was running into. Well, he was not much of a musician when the voyage was done. We sailed from Honolulu on the morning of September 23rd. The trade wind was blowing strong when we rounded the island and stood into it on a course north by east under close reef sails. With the coming of night, the happy isle faded from our sight, and out of the darkness frequent squalls swept down on us. When we were clear of the land, we set watches of 4 hours each and carried on day and night. The sea was rough enough at the start to affect the appetites of the crew, but the mate's stomach gave way in good old-fashioned style that relieved him somewhat, and he stuck to his watch gamely enough. We had taken on a large bunch of bananas when sailing from Honolulu, but I was not able to eat the lot myself. Thinking that the mate's appetite for bananas might improve later on, I tried preserving some of them in a mason jar. I packed the jar full of the ripe fruit, screwed on the lid, and set it in a pot of boiling water. I was busy with something else when the lid blew off with a startling report. For a moment, I thought the ship's magazine had blown up, and the whole interior cabin, including myself, was plastered with sticky mess. For some reason, the spectacle seemed to cheer the mate's spirits wonderfully. On the third day out, we built a fire and cooked a meal with vegetable soup, rice, flying fish, and toast on the menu. As it was impractical for small sailboats to beat back to California against the trade wind, our object was to stand to the northward until we were out of it. A course north by east was held until September 27th, when the latitude 28 north, we ran out of the trade winds. On the evening of that day, the wind died out and we were becalmed. The next morning, a light breeze sprung up out of the south and gradually came round to the southwest. In the evening, a fierce squall, the forerunner of a gale, struck us out of the northeast. We soon had sail reduced to reef mizzen and put out a sea anchor, and for 36 hours we lay drifting off to the southwest. The wind then came round east, and for another 36 hours we ran off to the north under shortened sail. At the end of that time, we ran out of the storm as suddenly as we ran into it. We were now in the region of variable winds north of the trades and made our way east by north as best we could. At times we were becalmed and went for a swim around the boat, and at other times we lay hove to in a head gale. We soon found that the Islander would heave to under storm jib and reef mizzen and be more comfortable than when riding it to sea anchor. Occasionally we had a day of sunshine when we could dry our wet garments, and Brooks would bring out his guitar and cheer us with a song. In our little world, every floating object that appeared to have once been connected with the land caused some excitement. Once we were becalmed, our curiosity was aroused by an object in the sea, and I swam out and brought in a cake of some waxy substance weighing about 15 pounds, but we were not chemists enough to tell what it was. Twice we saw lights passing in the night, and all hands came on deck to watch till they disappeared, but no vessels were sighted in daylight. Our highest latitude was 36 degrees north. We would find more westerly winds farther north, but already the night seemed cold to us. Just from the tropics, Brooks was beginning to dread his watch from 8 o'clock to midnight, which he called the graveyard watch, though I always took the watch from midnight to 4 o'clock. Like myself, Brooks had been an outdoor lad, and our conversations often turned to camp life in the Sierras, where our experiences had been similar. And now in the vast expanse of water, when night was coming on dark and gloomy and cold, salt spray was drenching the man at the tiller, Brooks would look at me pathetic-like and say, "Oh, let's go into camp." And we had several days of light, changeable winds, and at the same time, a long, heavy swell came rolling down from the north. My conclusion was that there was a severe storm raging over the Pacific farther north, and we were content to be where we were. Shortly after midnight on October 27th, the wind shifted from southwest to north by west and rose to a gale and a succession of squalls. But it was a favorable wind for us, and we made the best run of the voyage. The full moon was flooding the billows with light, while the Islander dashed in and out of cloud shadows and over foaming seas. Then, sitting on the deck amid drifting spray, we saw between flying cloud fragments the moon pass through the shadow in total eclipse. I had never witnessed eclipse amid a setting so wild, and it made a deeper impression on my mind than any similar phenomenon before or since. The wind increased and came around to the north by east, while we took in sail till only the mizzen and storm jib were left. Even under this short sail, the Islander moved slowly to eastward. During the storm, we estimated that the crests of the seas were more than 20 feet above the trough, but our little ship rode them buoyantly while we rested below, only taking a look out occasionally to see if all was well. To a farmer and an undertaker's son, it was a wonderful experience. By October 31st, the gale had blown itself out, and the sea was going down. We put on sail and shook out the reef after reef. The next day, under full sail, we ran into greenish-tinted water, and the sea was covered with drifting kelp that had been torn loose in a gale that had swept the northwest coast a few days earlier. From an observation of the sun at noon on November 2nd, I made out our position to be latitude 33 degrees 8 minutes, longitude 120 west, and laid a course to pass the southwest end of San Nicolas Island. We kept a close watch through the night, and early in the next morning, the sand dunes of San Nicolas lay close at hand on the port beam. So much for my second-hand watch and rough method of navigation. The landfall could not have been closer with cross bearings from two stars. It seemed strange that we moved at all in the calm that followed, but 2 days later the anchor was dropped in an old familiar cove at Catalina Island. 43 days from land to land, our clothes white and stiff with salt, but never feeling better. And what is remarkable, there had been no trouble between ourselves. I have read with interest the accounts of several amateur sailors who dwelt at length on how the land seemed to heave under them when going on shore after a long passage. It seems that Brooks and I had gotten over this amateur stage of the game, for when we struck out over the Catalina Hills, we were as much at home as two goats. Chapter 3. Off for the South Seas. I learned something of the sea on the voyage to Hawaii, and became acquainted with the Islander, for ships, like men, have personality of their own. My ship had become something more than just a fair-weather craft, and I had found the sea to be a great highway leading to wherever I wished to go. Confidence had come with experience, and I began preparations for a voyage to the South Seas. Such changes, as the experience suggested, were made in the rigging of the Islander. Parts were renewed or strengthened where they were weak. I made a sea anchor out of canvas, and I still had time on my hands. I made a new suit of sails. My friend W.S., who had given up the deep-sea idea, gave me his compass, which was larger than mine, and a taffrail log that would run. Charts and sailing directions were procured for the Marquesas, Society Islands, and Samoa, which places I intended to visit before returning to California. At the same time, I had it in my mind to extend the voyage if circumstances were favorable. When it came to provisioning the ship, my wants were simple. There was ample space for supplies, and of staples that would keep, such as beans, peas, rice, dried fruit, sugar, and bacon, I laid in sufficient supply to last for several months. For bread, I carried wheat and corn, which I ground in small handmill as needed. These were stored in tightly closed containers that excluded moisture and insects. Of tin goods, I had salmon, milk, and fruits, but the can opener never occupied a conspicuous place in the Islander's galley. I took along only what potatoes and onions and fresh vegetables could be used before spoiling, and renewed the supply at every opportunity. I always used whatever native fruits and vegetables could be obtained at the places I visited. Of water, I carried capacity for about 100 gallons. I can get along very well on a half a gallon per day. At sea, I use salt water for bathing purposes. I never fail to get results from my wood-burning stove. I have yet to come into a port hungry, and my health was good at the end of the longest runs. Sailing alone out on the great ocean is not a very cheerful prospect, and I contemplated taking along one of my acquaintances, of whom a number seemed to want to accompany me, but nothing came of it. After the return of the islander from Hawaii, my mate Brooks had gone to San Francisco, where he joined three other adventurers in the purchase of a small ketch, which they fitted out for trading and treasure hunting expedition along the south coast. Dissension had already broken out among the crew when Los Amigos arrived at Los Angeles Harbor. As a consequence, Brooks came ashore. We talked over the matter of his joining me, but memories of his experience on board Los Amigos and the graveyard watch on the islander caused him finally to decide for a career on the shore. So I went single-handed, and once underway, I was glad of it, for it was only the starting that was hard. At noon on November 18, 1921, I sailed from Los Angeles to the Marquesas Islands. A fair wind was blowing, and I sailed south rapidly enough to escape a storm that broke soon after my departure. At a later date, I learned the worst gale in years had swept the California coast, and there was much speculation as to whether my little craft would ride it out. But I had already passed out of the storm area. On the morning of the third day out, I was surprised to see the sun rising over some blue mountain peaks rising high on the eastern horizon. It was Guadalupe Island, but I had not realized that it was so high or that my course would take me in sight of it. It looked mysterious, and I wondered if anyone lived there, but the island quickly disappeared in the clouds that were gathering, and the north wind was sweeping me onward. For several days, I ran right before the wind with the sails jibing occasionally. Once, when I did not duck my head low enough, one of the reefing cleats caught me behind the ear. I fell on my hands and knees in the cockpit and for a moment forgot where I was. Down about the latitude 17 degrees north, a gale sprang up, and at nightfall I took off the main and mizzen sails. I put on the storm jib and hauled it flat amidships. Then, with the tiller lashed amidships, the islander drove off before it, requiring no attention, and there was no fear of her broaching to. It might be said that she was hove to stern first, but with the wind from the north, she was still going south 2 or 3 knots an hour. The sea was a seething white waste, and the motion was violent, so I did not sleep well. As I stood at the companionway watching the surges go by, one of them would occasionally boil over the stern and pour into the cockpit. The worst of the gale had blown out by morning, and I put on the close-reefed mainsail. All day we drove on over the tumbling seas till dusk, when I was glad to leave the islander to find her own way under the storm jib, while I went below to find refreshments and rest. There may have been much lost sleep, but the weather was never so bad that I could not cook a meal over my wood stove. It was the third day before the storm subsided, and I shook out the reefs. On the evening of that day, in latitude 11 degrees north, I saw a light flashing in the south, indicating the doldrums. Ahead of me, the next morning, two great black clouds formed, one on either hand. They rose to enormous height and spread out till they met above, and I sailed right into what appeared to be a vast tunnel between them. The rain fell in torrents, and at midday it was dark as dusk. At intervals, fierce squalls came shrieking along when I lowered all sail, and the islander ran off before the blast, doing about 6 knots under bare poles. Late in the afternoon, I saw light ahead and ran out of the storm. I was entering the doldrums, the region of storms and calms. Sometimes it was sunshine, then again it rained the day through. I filled my empty water bottles, and I could have caught water for the voyage in a single downpour. There were gusts of wind springing up from every quarter, and there was a squall in sight most of the time. A fair wind would breeze up only to die out, leaving my craft tossing in the cross seas. While endeavoring by all means to go south, there was one day when I gained only 1 minute of latitude, the equivalent of 1 mile in 24 hours. I had little sleep, for I was on the alert day and night to catch any stray puffs of wind that came my way. The scenery up in the cloudland was wonderful, And often I had schools of fishes or porpoises for company. One lone dolphin played around my boat for 2 days and seemed to be watching me when I leaned over the side. Once I went swimming with the dolphin around my ship. The islander with all sails set looked strange and large when I swam off to one side so as to get a better view. And as she rose and fell on the wave, she seemed to be gliding away, and I thought how lonesome I would be if she went off and left me alone on the sea. There was an almost irresistible impulse to rush to her side and climb on board, though there was no wind, and the sails and tiller were set to bring her up into the wind if it blew. But the wind did blow once in a while, else I should be in the doldrums yet. One night the wind came up fair when the sea was so phosphorescent that I could see the light of the water thrown off the bow flash on the sails. The next morning a gale was blowing from the southeast. In 2 days it had settled down to a steady breeze from east by south. I had met the southeast trade wind in latitude 5 degrees north. During the forenoon of December 21st, in the longitude 129 degrees west, I crossed the equator. It was my first time, but no special ceremony was held on board. The monotony of the run down the southeast trades was broken now and then by the appearance of some bird or sea creature that was new to me. I saw for the first time the man-o-war bird, whose picture I was familiar with in The Old Prince of the Sea. One day there appeared ahead what seemed to be a patch of floating kelp, when alongside I made out the head and flippers of an enormous turtle of startling proportions in the midst of a mass of seaweed that was clinging to it. The thing was most likely harmless, but I did not stop to molest it. With most sea creatures, the main object of life appears to be to eat or be eaten, but the porpoises often seem to be gamboling about for the joy of it. Schools of porpoises would often play about the islander until I began to distinguish individuals from their fellows by some peculiar markings or scars. One of those would leap vertically high in the air and spin around like a top. At last, according to my reckonings, I was in the neighborhood of the Marquesas Islands. Great numbers of birds were seen, and I began to watch for the appearance of land. Up to the time of sailing into the doldrums, I had made such good time that I was beginning to look forward to making the passage some 3,000 miles in 30 days. But what with 2 weeks in the doldrums and the light winds south of the line, the voyage had lengthened out until I was going to appreciate the land when I set foot on it once more. The morning of December 30th was cloudy. I was up at 3:30, but could see only clouds on the horizon. The islander was sailing along under the jib and mizzen sail, doing 3 or 4 knots. I went to sleep again and awoke at dawn. Springing up quickly, I looked out, and there right ahead, seeming very close, lay Wahooka Island, with its green peak rising into a veil of clouds. I ran close by the south side of the island and saw houses under the trees, but the inmates were not stirring. Sailing on, I passed 2 small islets, the home of innumerable birds that flew in a cloud over the surrounding sea. After drifting out of a calm under the lee of Wahooka, I stood away to where Nukuhiva lay dimly outlined in the clouds and mist. Out in the channel, the wind came strong and squally. I lowered the mainsail and tied in the second reef before putting it out again. I cooked my breakfast and shaved the stubble of the voyage from my face. I had read so much of Nukuhiva, and so long had I pored over the chart and sailing directions, that it seemed like turning over the pages of a familiar book as the headlands and bays opened out to view. The wind blew strong, and the sea was running high when I came up off Cape Martin. A squall swept out of Controller Bay, but the islander, under her shortened sail, drove on before it. Then came the 2 sentinel rocks with Taiohae Bay opening out between them. Standing in, I ran under the lee of the land and began beating up to the anchorage with gusts of wind that came down from the lofty mountains, first from one hand and then from the other. I could see houses on the shore and smoke rising from among the trees, and I knew that the place was inhabited. And I was joyous with the knowing that I was to break my solitude and meet fellow beings. When the sun was low over the peaks of Nukuhiva, I dropped anchor off the beach at Tahoe after 42 days at sea, during which time there was never the sight of sail or the smoke of a passing steamer. Andre Alexander, the French commissioner, came off, and after he learned that I came from California, welcomed me, come on shore and have dinner with me. I lived in San Francisco for years. I went on the shore where a group of residents had gathered and were discussing the mysterious stranger who had arrived all alone. Bob McKittrick, the local storekeeper, translated some of his native wit for my benefit. One of them said, he did start with someone, but he killed him on the way. That is the first three chapters, Around the World Single-Handed by Harry Pigeon. You can get the ebook on Amazon, or if you want to hear the rest of that, that's probably about 1/8 of the book, something like that. You can get it on patreon.com/slowboatsailing for a $5 pledge, and that also gets you my Amazon bestsellers, How to Sail Around the World Part-Time and Slow Boat to Cuba, which both topped the sailing category at one point on Amazon. So everybody knows about Joshua Slocum, who was the first man to sail around the world solo and also in a small yacht. And he went through the Straits of Magellan and really kind of took an odd route that nobody takes, in part because the Panama Canal did not exist while he was alive. He was lost at sea before the Panama Canal was built. Harry Pigeon, besides being the second man to sail around the world solo, was the first man to sail around the world twice in a small yacht. In just a second, I'm going to tell you about our episode 48 guest of the Slow Boat Sailing Podcast, but first a word from our sponsor.
Mantis Anchors founder Greg Cutson tells why they created a modular design that can be easily stowed away for their revolutionary anchor.
Well, you literally have some time, just a few seconds, to deploy something. And that something you deploy better work. And sometimes it better work at short scope. And we want to make an anchor modular. It's not just because we want you to have a spare for a hurricane, you know, be able to put away a monster. But we want you to be able to have a spare for an emergency, meaning a spare anchor needs to have the same setting performance as your primary. That was kind of the thought. So we wanted to have, we didn't want to change the design, we wanted to have the main anchor as something that is modular, so you can use it for a variety of applications.
You can get Mantis anchors and their other innovative sailing gear at mantismarine.com or other fine retailers.
The episode 48 guest is Gone with the Wind. So excited to have Nikki and Jason on the podcast, and it's my hope we're going to bump into each other in the South Pacific, but you're going to hear their amazing story from going from RVing to sailing around the world, and they're doing a great job, and they make awesome videos. It's my hope to have that up by the time this episode is up on the Slow Boat Sailing YouTube channel, so you can listen to that and not have to wait until May, but we'll also bring it to your podcast feed in May. I'm Linus Wilson. Until next time, have some fun on the water. Bye-bye.
Hi, I'm Jana Wilson. Thank you for listening to the Slow Boat Sailing Podcast. Subscribe to our free newsletter at slowboatsailing.com.